75% of Americans believe in UFOs. 30% of Americans believe UFOs are vehicles from other worlds. And 3% of Americans believe they have been abducted by aliens. That's over 8 million people. They're out there, aren't they?
Welcome to the UFO Files Show. With your host, Jerry Pippin.
Well, this is Jerry Pippin, and once again, we're broadcasting from Dolan Springs, the gateway to Lake Mead. That's what the sign says, Rod.
As a matter of fact, I never saw that sign all the times I went up the road.
It's there, right, Wes Bateman?
That it's there. I've seen it a few times, but there also I think they erased it. It was also the gateway to the Grand Canyon, you know, the west.
In fact, the road that comes in here, you can take it all the way to the backside of the Grand Canyon, I guess.
That's right. That's it.
And we stopped down at Critters and before we came to see Wes Bateman, and I'm getting to know this place, Wes. Doesn't take too long, though, does it?
Well, it's nice and quiet, isn't it? You know, all we got once in a while, the coyote will walk by, or the cottontail will hop through the yard. That's all the excitement we have in Dolan Springs.
Yeah. But it's a good quiet place for you to do the work, and we talked a little bit about the SETI messages last time we interviewed you. And we'll get into that here in a little bit, because it's just earth-shaking what you're coming up with. You really accomplished quite a lot, I
guess. Since we last talked, we've had could be considered breakthroughs. It's hard to classify our findings. They're exciting to us, of course. They help us get a focus. The messages have now become understandable and coherent. In other words, we feel they're more explainable. That has been a problem, you know, how to explain what the messages are saying. I think we can pretty well say that the first part is speaking of the Great Pyramid and its geometry. There's reference to many physical features of the pyramid. And of course, there's also reference to the hydrogen atom. And to the system itself, what I call the raw system.
We talked about that mathematical system before, and you went into great detail about it. I don't think we were taping at the time, but Rod, he's quite the mathematician.
A serious mathematician.
He kind of left me in the dark, Wes, but I got the general gist. Don't you tell our listeners what we're talking about this mathematical system. It's an ancient system, right?
I discovered it in the fall of 1975, actually. And when I was researching the geometry of the Great Pyramid, it's been a... actually, it began with me getting three early Christmas gifts. A lady friend, her husband had passed away, and we were kind of staying with her during her period of grief. And she was a piano teacher. She taught piano and so forth. One day she came home with two things. She said, Wes, I want you to early Christmas present. And she gave me a address book, and in the back of the address book was a number of formulas and mathematical terms and things like that, and a small handheld calculator. And And right on the tail end of that, another friend who came in to visit had a book by Peter Tompkins, which was The Secret of the Great Pyramid. And so with those three things, I just, of course, I was in the, I was working in the area of biofeedback. Especially alpha, what they call alpha biofeedback.
Now, is this with the music and you bring the plants up?
Or well, no. Biofeedback is when utilizing an instrument with electrodes. For instance, in the case of alpha, you would put the electrodes on the on both sides of the temple, and then a person would try to relax, and while doing that, the machine would beep. So that's called a feedback signal, a signal. And as a person learns to cause the machine to continue beeping, they go into a state of relaxation. That was called alpha biofeedback training. Okay, but more on to the system. I noticed in the book that there was reference to that the pyramid had two numbers that have long been associated with it. One is pi, which is the ratio between a circle's diameter and its circumference. And the other is a number known as phi, P-H-I. And that number has long been recognized as having a relationship to just about everything in nature. Plants, the value of phi is 1.618033989. Now, if you divide that into 1, you get 0.618033989. Which means that if one is a number whose reciprocal is actually its fractional part or its decimal. Phi is a number, there's such a thing as what you call phi proportions or that are golden rectangles and things of this nature. But it was in the study of the pyramid that I had realized that over the years people were very confused about what actual units of measure were used in the pyramid. Of course, in the days that they believed the pyramid was built, the ancients were using units we call cubits. A lot of people, when you say cubit, they remember Noah's Ark, 300 cubits, and so forth and so on. Well, the long cubit is from the tip of the longest finger to the shoulder. And the short cubit is between that longest right. finger and the elbow. And so over the years, there's been a controversy. In fact, they called it the Babel of the cubits, because everybody had a pet cubit. It was everybody said no, it was built on this cubit, it was built on this one. And anytime your cubit wouldn't fit, they say, well, that's just due to primitive work. The primitives did not have a sense of accuracy, Well, when you look at that pyramid, it is an amazing structure. It covers 13.5 acres. It's over 481 British feet in height. Okay. Now, there was a fellow in the 1800s, I think his name was Taylor. He was the publisher of an English newspaper, and he he determined that the height to the base, there was a pi relationship. In fact, of 1/2 pi. That would mean that the height to the perimeter of the base was actually as a radius of a circle would be to a circumference. Well, of course, in those days, the pyramid was very difficult to explore. The whole outer area was covered with rubble. The Arabs had stripped away the 22.5 acres of limestone that once had covered it and took that limestone into Cairo and built mosques and palaces with it. So they were using it as a quarry. But the whole lower level was hard. You couldn't navigate over the stuff. So it's very difficult to determine the actual size of the base. And then there's many explorers that came into it. But the idea of it being pi, pi had been carried out to tens of thousands of points of the decimal, and it never been rational, so we called it an irrational number because you can't write it as a fraction. And we called it transcendental as well, a transcendental number, because it is the comprehended is beyond the range of our senses, that it just goes on and on and on. Well, when anybody brought up the idea that the ancient Egyptians, just the ancient Egyptians, knew about pi, everybody would laugh or say, "You're fools to think that." But for years, that has always been a question. If pi was that embodied in the pyramid deliberately with knowledge, or was it by
happen? It doesn't seem to me that that would be the case. Right. It was by design.
Well, we have found out it is definitely by design. Here's where the biofeedback comes into it. Alpha biofeedback. Human being produces four distinct brainwave patterns, which are called delta, theta, alpha, and beta. Delta and theta we produce when we're asleep or unconscious. Theta waves we produce mainly when we're dreaming. And it relates to what they call rapid eye movement. Although a child who's hyperactive will generate theta while they're awake. Let's jump over alpha for a moment. Beta, we produce beta waves when we're aware of everything that's going on around us. You know, we're conscious of everything. Now, coming back to alpha, alpha we produce when we're relaxed or in a passive state of mind. Now, the average alpha wave that we produce is about 10.6 cycles. 10.6. Now, that's very important, so just hang on to that for a minute.
Okay, I will. 10.6.
That's the average alpha that we generate, okay, more than any other alpha wave, 10.6 cycles. Now, this is where I had come across a paper written by a Dr. Polk and Fishen from the University of Rhode Island, and it was titled "The Human Resonance of the Earth's Ionosphere Cavity." And what this paper explained was that lightning generates very low frequency, ELF, extremely low frequency, waves. And these waves bounce back and forth between the ionosphere and the Earth. So in other words, the ionosphere and the Earth act like a natural resonance cavity, similar to a resonance cavity of a guitar or violin, okay? Well, that it to show you how things come together. The thought came to mind that the pyramid might act as a secondary resonance cavity. And like putting a guitar inside a guitar. And that those elf waves could be concentrated in that second cavity. And those elf waves could, in fact...
Wes, let's talk a little bit about them breaking into... I guess you had all this anti-gravitational material, the thing that you had developed using the Ra system. You had it in storage, is that right? And then somebody took it? It just disappeared overnight?
Well, yeah. The place was absolutely, there wasn't this was a pretty good storage facility, you know. It's pretty large. You know, they took even everything, even the dust off the floor. You know what I'm saying? I would say that the storage, what would you say, the size of this room is about twice as big as this. And the lock was a key. It was not a combination lock. And when we went there, we had to, of course, unlock the door to get into it. So whoever got in there, unlocked it with a key or... And the thing that always comes to my mind is this thing was made of, we had special alloy balls, spheres, that were one-third iron, one-third cobalt, and one-third nickel, which is the three magnetics. And they were hollow. And they were filled with the element thallium. Now, thallium is number 81 on the atomic periodic table, but it's also poisonous. So if they ever took it apart, I hope they washed their hands, But they used a thallium in rat poison, but we were using it as a neutral of the Ra system identified thallium as neutral. In fact, today, you see, thallium is number 81. Lead is 82. Now, if you take the three magnetics, you got cobalt. Let's start with iron, cobalt, and nickel. Well, iron, the number of iron is 26. Cobalt 27 and nickel 28. Add those three together, you'll get 81. Those are the three magnetics. Now 81 is 9 times 9. And 81 times 81 is 6561, which is, if you were looking at that as this a wavelength, would be the Balmer M3 spectral line of hydrogen. Okay. But back to the thallium. The universe is built on the basis of the Ra system of mathematics. There's no doubt about it. This system is the mathematical language that nature uses to describe itself, from the very smallest atom to the largest galaxy. And when you look at this, for a long time, people say the universe is operating in a state of chaos. It's not. It's working on the order of this mathematical system. And it shows that there is a divine plan. And where there's a divine plan, there's a divine planner. And or a creator of all that is. But the thallium is very important. It's abundant on the Earth, okay. But remember the green fireballs Jerry, back in the 50s.
Oh, yeah, we talk about those on our shows regularly. In fact, every once in a while you hear of a report of a green fireball these days, but back in the 50s, that was quite common.
Right. I've talked to people that have actually seen them traveling horizontally, you know, one group, like these members, were on their way from Los Angeles to Las Vegas, and the green fireballs just traveling horizontally, and obviously a blaze. That these things are burning. Well, thallium in Greek means budding twig, and it was thallium was discovered by a guy looking through a spectroscope and seeing a bright green line. Okay, that's its identification. That's its spectral fingerprint, that bright green line. Now, thallium, recall, neutral. Okay, I'm going to tell you right now, and we can come back to it. But thallium, if you put it into any element, can be changed into a plasma. A plasma is, you've got solid, liquid, gas, and plasma. Super hot gas. And if these ships were operating using a thallium plasma, if that plasma tube became ruptured for some reason, you're going to get green fire. And that's exactly what you got there.
So that would explain why it was
right.
Green.
The color of the green fireballs is the same wavelength as the that prominent spectral line in thallium.
Rod Wes was talking to us about the pyramids and the first message from outer space. It's amazing that all these things just kind of go together.
It does tie together. There's everything that Wes has been talking about, and there's things that he's been sharing with me that go back to 75 and go back to right to today. Everything ties together and is based on pi and phi.
I know, Wes, we're going to get into, we do a lot of UFO sightings, and before the program's over, I want to talk to you about UFO sightings and earthquakes. They seem to be very connected, and we'll get into that in a minute, but let's talk a little bit more about, I don't want to interrupt you, about the pyramids.
All right.
And so this first message is connected to the pyramids,
right.
You say.
Let's do it this way. The people that put these messages on the internet as a game, they call themselves the Contact Project, and these messages were on the internet as a game for 7 years. Now, two messages gave us a clue that they're real. Mainly, the number of these messages are laid out on tones. You know, it's kind of reminiscent of the Close Encounters of the Third Kind. You know, you know.
Yes.
The first message, they claim, had 19 tones in it, each one successively a higher pitch. So they assigned the lowest tone the capital letter A, and the highest tone the capital letter S. Well, 19, well, that didn't, that was meaningless. But then they said that the second message had 18.
We were talking about
that. The second message had 18 new tones, and they just assigned the first tone of that message T and so forth, until they ran out of capital letters. Then they started on the small case letters. But what came to my mind was the fact that message number one and number two had 37 tones in it. Okay. So we had 37 tones. Well, after 35 years of working with the Great Pyramid and the Ra system, I immediately recognized that there was a good possibility that those 37 tones had a relationship to a table, which is called the Ra Table of Nines, which is 27, 54, 108, 81, 108, 135. In other words, 27 plus 27 plus 27. That would mean that the, okay, now we look at the message itself, and we have, we're going to say it in their way they would say it, G, B, G. And that's just three little letters there, right? And the other thing they said was that each tone lasted about 0.492 seconds. About. If this is the game, why not say exactly? About. Well, G is the seventh letter of the alphabet. There are seven periods of the periodic table of elements. The Grand Gallery of the Great Pyramid has seven ceilings and 37 individual overlapping stones that compose those ceilings. So then we look at GBG, and it was G's the seventh letter, okay? So the G's are actually like bookends, okay? The only thing important about that little section is the letter B. Capital letter B. Well, B's the second letter, right? So we would assign that the value of 54. Now, let's just take the length of the tone, 0.492 seconds, and divide it into 54. The answer was so astonishing. As you say, blows your mind. The answer is a number 109, you know, and so forth. And that number is known in physics as the Rydberg constant for infinite mass. That number is used in simple equations to mathematically determine the spectral lines of hydrogen from the infrared to the ultraviolet. Now, dividing 0.492 into 54 doesn't bring that out exactly. So it turns out that the length of the tone is not about 0.492. It's actually 0.492075. If you divide 0.492075 into 54, you get the Rydberg constant. Now, they claimed in their game that these messages were received on the 1420 megahertz frequency, which is known as the hydrogen resonance frequency. Okay, they sometimes refer to it as the magic frequency. It's the frequency that they believe any extraterrestrial race would utilize, you know, because it would be common to any intelligent of beings, that was what that was. So, what do we got here? We got hydrogen in the Rydberg, and we got on the 420 megahertz. So they're talking about hydrogen, aren't they? Let's go to the next one. The next one is GBBG. Let's take our, let's call it 54 times 54. The answer to that is 2,916. A light bulb goes off. The number 2,916 is a well-known number to just about any Egyptologist that ever lived. There is an ancient unit of measure that comes to us from a time before there were even pharaohs in Egypt, what you call the pre-dynastic time. There was a unit of measure that was used to weigh gold and silver. It was called the Atarba, A-R-T-A-B-A. The Atarba consisted of 29,160 cubic centimeters. So in other words, 54 times 54 gives you 2,916, where the 29,160 is just raised by the power of 10. Hydrogen atom, ancient Egypt, right? Now let's look at 54 times 54. That's a square. Okay, if you find the diagonal of that square, you're going to get the number 76.3, so on. That is the number of what you call green raw feet in the base of the Great Pyramid of Giza. Now we have no doubt whatsoever they're referring to the pyramid. They're talking about the hydrogen atom, they're talking about the pyramid. Okay? What the guys at this Project Contact did not realize is that there were actually two units at times. We figured out what the other one was. The other one is the, if you take 1 and divide it by 81 times 40, it's going to give you 0.4938. Okay, that's the other unit. And you divide, now we take that unit and come back and divide it into 54, the first 54. And you get the number 121.5. Well, that's the wavelength of the hottest line of hydrogen. That's the line that has the most energy in it. Okay? Now we take just one more little thing. I hope they're not making this confusing. But we discovered that each tone had three values. Okay, we've been talking about the tone having, like a B54. Actually, it has a value of 6, 18, and 54. We came up with it because that is a number that's expressed in the pyramid all the time. In other words, if you take what is called the apothem of the pyramid, the line that comes down the each face, from the feet to the base. Now, the Great Pyramid has an indented apothem. Okay, we call that the ghost apothem. But let's just use it. If you divide the apothem into the perimeter, you'll get that number. If you take what we call a sequence, a raw sequence, which is 1 divided by 81 gives you 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, and the 8th missing, 9, 0. And you multiply that by 40, you're going to get that number. This number was also extrapolated out of measurements made by Richard Hoagland and Earl Charon at Cydonia on the planet Mars when they did research on the distances that the buildings were separated and things like that. They misunderstood. They thought that value was 5. See, it's 0.49. They thought that was 5. Okay. Mistakenly. So they were using a number that they said they took a square, the square root of 5. Well, if you take the square root of the number I'm talking about, you're going to get 0.22222222. And that is what you call the sixth repetend, or 6 divided by 27. Okay? Now, I don't want to get too much in math, because it's easier to come back to the messages and point out why we're excited. It's easy to understand the math if you're looking at it. You don't have to be a genius to understand it. But whoever wrote it was certainly a genius. Because they perfectly put this message, these messages together, the way they're written is important. We're learning, as I say, every day. But back to the first truth. Now we take, so you take it and divide it by 6 by the time unit. You get the 1.5, which is the hotline hydrogen. You take the 18 and divide it by that number, and you get 36.45. Or if you move the decimal to the right, it would be 364.5. That number is well known in physics as the Balmer constant for hydrogen. Use that in simple formulas, and it will give you the wavelength for hydrogen that we can see. Now you go to the 54, of course, and with this one, and it's going to give you 109.35. That is an infrared line in hydrogen. That's called bracket, I think it's bracket M6, in the infrared. So if this is a coincidence, you know, there's no way it can be. There's no way this could be made up. Can you imagine somebody coming up with the hot hydrogen mines, the Balmer constant, the Rydberg constant, as tones that represent an extraterrestrial message, a fictitious message? No way. No way. So our progress has, up until 2002, all the years I spent researching the Ross system, my thought it only had five formats, okay? Now, due to the messages, we know it has 360. It's 360 formats. So our knowledge has expanded. Now, coming back to our 54 times 54, that indicates that they wanted us to mathematically put together a pyramid with a 54-foot or 54-unit side. So we did, mathematically and on paper. And the relationship of that pyramid, which we call the ET pyramid, the difference between it and the Great Pyramid is simply 2. You're like one feature, you compare the height to the other. You're either going to get 2 or you're going to get the square root of 2. Like you take the base, compare the base to the other base, you're going to get the square root of 2. Or the cross section to the other cross section, you're going to get the same thing. So it's obvious that they wanted us to look at that. Now, it's been a long mystery. In fact, in the 1800s, the British had they're famous for putting out prizes. If you can, you know, like they got the guy to build the clock so they could do better navigation at sea, and then you give a prize. And it's like Rutan and his spaceship one, you know, to get you go ahead and build it, and then you get $10 million.
Right. So they had a prize for this.
That's right. So they had a prize for somebody who could square the circle.
And so they had this prize back in the 1800s.
Right. Basically, in the cold winter nights in England in the fog, these guys would be sitting there with their pencils and trying to figure out how to do this. Never could, because what they're probably dealing with is the infinitesimal value of pi. You know, how can you accurately, make such a switch? Well, it came to us that there was a way to do this, and it's very simple. The value is 1.125. Okay. And if you divide that into 1, you're going to get the number 0.8888888, which is 24 divided by 27. But let's start with our 1.125. Take 54, okay, multiply it by that, and you're going to get the number 60.75. Now, that's the diameter of the circle. But the thing here is the value of, if you use that number, it sets the other thing you're working with up to be handled differently. Now, there's a number which is called omega minor pi, which is 3.16 oh blah, blah, blah. Okay? Use that value for pi to do it, and it comes out exactly, the area of that thing comes out exactly 2916. Okay, exactly. So, essentially, what you've done is squared the circle. Now, can you do that with a cube? You know? You can. But you see, a cube. It's 3 times 54 times 54, 54 times 54 times 54 gives you a, again, the numbers are heavy. If I had them in front of me, it's a lot easier. I don't get tired trying to recall them by memory. But the area of the 6 faces of this particular cube to its volume is exactly 9, which is the magic number to Ross system and of the messages, because you actually got 81 tones in these messages in 9 messages. So 81 times 80, 9 times 9 is 81, and you've got 9 messages. Okay. So what this tells us is, you end up with, when you use this other version of pi, like I was saying, in the formula for finding a sphere, the 60.75, and you're supposed to remember 10.6 here, we come back to that, but the 60.75, and you use, of course, it's 4 times pi and so forth. And then you divide it by 3, and it gives you the number of cubes in the sphere. In this case, you're going to end up with the number 118.098, okay? Well, that is not the size of the cube, okay? What it discovered here is that what they've been doing is, there are 2 kinds of cubes, little ones and big ones. So in this process, you're converting them to into small cubes. So you got more of them. Do you understand? And then, so it's a way to adjust the formula, and it comes out exactly right. See, they hadn't realized that in their conversions, they were coming up with small cubes. Do you understand? where there's such a thing as small cubes and large cubes. So what I'm trying to say is that we've done that now, been able to determine the size of the electron, the size of the proton, the size of the neutron, and how many of these large cubes and small cubes are in these particles. And apparently, you can charge some of the large ones and not charge the small ones. Okay, and mix and match is what I'm trying to say. So it could open up a new form of physics on how to convert matter into, you know, what makes a proton instead of a positron instead of a electron. It's because maybe the small cubes are charged and the big ones aren't, so it's positive, or vice versa. So what I'm saying is exciting. You know, you talk about mind-blowing. And we have not even got past the first three sections of the first message in what I'm explaining here. And there are 46 sections in the first message. The third message has over 1,500 tones. So you can see why we wanted to try to find a way to accelerate this. You know, we got to find a way to accelerate it.
Do you have an idea?
Well, we did.
What we need to do? What do we need to do?
Well, it was a bad idea, the last one, because NIDS, the National Institute for Discovery Science, had been presenting themselves for years as being a group that had the capability and the integrity. And if they say, oh, whatever we find, we're going to publish. So then that is a long story. It's not a good one. We approached them, we gave them a certain material, and they kept asking for more. They wanted the information, but they wanted nothing to do with us. Let's put it that way. When finally we knew that they were just dangling a carrot, you know, Mr. Bigelow's money, we just said that's enough of it. And we refused to give them any more information. And then the NID story goes on and on, but...
Well, Wes, are you looking for somebody else to help you with this now? Or?
Well, of course.
Right.
We could use some personnel that have certain abilities in computers and so forth. And we would like to do a crypto-analytical program which NID claimed they were going to do, but they didn't realize that they need the pyramid data. They couldn't possibly put together a program to solve these messages without that information. And they knew that only we had that information, 35, 40 years of researching it. So they needed us, but they didn't like that fact. So they thought they could do it on their own without that information. Well, it will not work, not knowing that. But with a crypto analytical program, with the pyramid data plugged into it, we could move ahead a lot faster. No way can I say how fast we'll move, but we'll move a lot faster. Now, in these messages could be any number of things. It could be a cure for diseases that have troubled us for years. It could be a landing date. You know, it could be a very urgent thing. These things were on the internet for 7 years, and they went off in 2002. Now that's 9 years. I think they're more. I think they're 2 years older. You see,
than that.
Yeah. So I think we're talking 10, 11 years ago. These things were transmitted.
Do you have any idea where these messages are coming from out there?
Yes, they come from inside our solar system. That's one of the reasons you got a problem with SETI. She said he wants to hear something, but they want it to be 11 light years away, so that it takes 11 years to talk, 11 years to answer. In the meantime, everybody gets a paycheck. You know, the joke is I'm putting the... See, SETI, there's a lot of SETIs. You got C-SETI, you got the SETI League, the SETI Institute, and these. But I'm going to put one together that's called the Search for Egotistical Terrestrial Idiots.
That's good.
You know,
that's good.
You know, well, what we're going to do, as long as the money holds out, we're going to look for extraterrestrials on Waikiki. Or, remember the Conehead movie where Dan Aykroyd,
yes,
they were aliens, right, and they told their neighbors they were from France? Well, that's where we think we'll go. We'll look for aliens over in France.
What's a question? If something 11 light years away, would that be outside our heliopause?
Yes, it certainly would.
And if something was outside our heliopause, would we realistically get a signal from outside?
I'm glad you brought that up, Rod, because that's exactly what's happening here. You're getting signals, but what they started out to be is not what we get. And in other words, it's changed in its movement through space. The signal is altered or gets changed. Now, how can you say that? Well, we live in a magnetic, a gravitational lens. We call it our solar system. If you're inside of that lens, where we are, if you go out at night, you look up, you see the stars. The light from the stars, you're there. Now, if you travel to the extreme end of our solar system, to an edge, the edge, it's called the heliopause, as you know. If you cross the heliopause, you have no influence from the sun. In fact, the Pioneer spacecraft out there are having a problem leaving the solar system. You know, it's one of those little things that are going on that not too many people are talking about. These things just can't get out, okay? They keep getting pulled back in at that one point. Now, if you were able to have one foot inside the solar system and one foot out, but you, okay, let's say you went out of the solar system and you looked up at the sky, you wouldn't see a thing. It'd be totally black. No starlight, no nothing. If you step back in to the solar system and look up, there's the stars. So light as we know it only manifests inside a solar system. The distance between solar systems don't exist. No, it does and it don't. Okay, now that sounds contradictory, but you got to understand this. If you've run certain experiments on light, the results are going to say light is in the form of little energy packets called photons. Okay? Now you run another type of experiment, and it says light is in the form of waves. Now, which is right? What form is it in? It's in both. It's alternating back and forth between one and the other. Okay. Now, that alternation, that going back and forth, governs the speed of light inside a lens. It says that the speed of light is 186,233 miles a second inside a vacuum.
Wes, I think this would be a good place to wrap up this first hour. We're going to talk to you some more about these messages from outer space on another hour coming up pretty soon. But the time is up. The clock has us. Basically, we discussed this before, remember? And it was basically the fact that that's how you get warp drive on Star Trek, and you were instrumental in getting that done. In other words, you go to the end of the light lens of our solar system, and voila, you end up at somebody else's solar system into their light lens. So you take a shortcut, so to speak, warp it out as you beat Einstein's theory of relativity. Wes, I've enjoyed it. We're from Dolan Springs. That's in Arizona, right on the Arizona side of Lake Mead, back into the desert. Interesting place. Interesting person, Wes Bateman. Thanks for being here. Our own location producer was Roberta Scott. I'm Jerry Pippin. Until next time, cheers.
If you're looking for adventure, information, and entertainment on the internet, one stop fits all, jerrypippin.com. At jerrypippin.com, you'll find multimedia entertainment at its best. Almost 2 million people are enjoying hours of entertainment and information. Hit it now. www.jerrypippin.com.